I effortlessly lost 25 pounds when I switched from a non-fat and low-fat vegetarian diet to a real food diet, which included real fats and as many of them as I wanted.
That's food writer Nina Plank, and this is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Well, happy Thanksgiving. Today's theme is, what else? Food. Our first guest is Nina Plank. We'll hear about real food from her. And later in the show, we'll talk to food psychologist Brian Wanzink about how we can painlessly avoid overeating. But first, are such fatty foods as butter, beef, and full-fat cheese good for you? Yes, says Nina Plank, as long as they're real, from cows that live and eat organically out in the pasture. And low-fat vegetarian food may in fact be deadly if it's produced industrially. Nina Plank is a leading expert on farmers' markets and local food. She started the London's Farmers' Markets in 1999, a company that now runs 15 farmers' markets in that city. She also was director of Green Market, the largest group of farmers' markets in the United States. She's written the Farmers' Market Cookbook. Now she comes out with Real Food, What to Eat and Why. It's about why foods produced by traditional methods not only taste better, but are better for you. Plank, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, in writing Real Food, What to Eat and Why, you start out talking about your own upbringing, that you grew up on a farm, and how that introduced you to real food. Tell us a bit about that experience.
Well, my mother was completely dedicated to real food, and a reader of Adele Davis, the pioneering common sense popular nutrition writer of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So that meant that we ate simple American food, meat, vegetables, poultry, always lots of fruit and vegetables at every meal. We ate whole grain bread. We made our own granola. And we never ate foods that were engineered to be low in anything or high in anything. So she wouldn't have bought fat-free yogurt or low-carb bagels or antioxidant-rich orange juice. It was just simple whole foods.
May I ask, what kind of health are your parents?
My parents are fit as two fiddles at 65. Still farming full-time in Virginia, where I grew up, and selling at farmers markets.
I was a suburban girl, and I can remember the milkman coming and delivering our milk every morning and the cream being on top and how delicious that was. Talk about milk a little bit.
It's not such a long time ago that we had all these foods, you know, less than a generation in a lot of communities. The replacement of real food with industrial food has been so swift. And milk is a great example because there are many milks. Milk is a very complex food, and the gap between traditional milk or real milk and industrial milk is very large.
Okay, so let's define some terms maybe before we go on. What is the difference between real food and industrial food?
Well, real food, in my book, means food that we've eaten for a long time, and it's more or less the way it used to be. And when I say the way it used to be, I mean largely unchanged. So real food would be beef that's raised on grass rather than corn and soybean and antibiotics and steroids and, unfortunately, parts of other cattle, which is what industrial beef looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And industrial foods, by contrast, if real food is old and traditional, industrial foods are recent and synthetic. So that might mean that they've invented the food completely in the lab or the factory, like the fake butter that they were selling us as heart healthy, which is really just corn oil that's been zapped with hydrogen atoms. Or it might mean a food that has been so refined and processed that it doesn't really resemble the real version anymore. A good example of that is non-fat milk protein that's been dried and powdered. Doesn't really resemble whole milk in terms of nutrients or flavor.
Well, you know, here's a question that's foremost on my mind. Eggs, butter, cheese, hamburgers, even ice cream are good for you?
Yeah, all these foods, most of them fall into the category of the dreaded saturated fats, don't they? But they're sort of special possible villainy around things like red meat and cancer. So I looked into each of these foods and all the nutrients they contained and all the charges against them. And what I concluded is that real food, the food we've been eating for a long time, is not responsible for the triple epidemic of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease in this country. And again, I found that industrial foods like corn oil and corn syrup and white flour and trans fats and powdered milk are responsible. And we could talk about a couple of the particulars like saturated fats or protein.
Well, let's do that. And actually, maybe we could start by talking about some of the difference between, say, real beef and industrial beef. You've already talked a little bit about milk. Maybe we'll just take a few of these foods. Let's start with beef.
Sure. Well, let's see. Beef and dairy cattle, as it happens, are meant to live on grass and its equivalent, dried grass or hay. But in the 1950s, it started to be more convenient for industrial farmers to confine them instead of putting them out on pasture and instead feed them concentrated feed, soy and corn, often, unfortunately, animal protein, even though they're herbivores, and then also to give them antibiotics in the case of beef and hormones in the case of both beef and dairy cattle. And this has had unhappy effects for the ecology, for animal health, and for the quality of the meat and the beef they give us.
Give us some details on that.
If cows, beef or dairy, are raised on grass, their natural diet, their meat and their dairy contains more omega-3 fats. Those are the extremely healthy fats that are found mostly in fish oil. And the standard industrial diet is very much deficient in omega-3 fats. These foods, when they're raised on grass, also contain more vitamin E, which they get from living green grass, and beta-carotene, which is also from living plants, and your body converts to vitamin A.
In other words, they're taking in the nutrients that we need that they don't take in otherwise. What about mad cow disease? I mean, I stopped eating red meat, actually, a while ago when I found out about mad cow disease, and I didn't really trust that it wasn't in the food supply here in the United States because I didn't think they'd probably tell us if it were.
That's a really important point. I was in Britain during the mad cow disease episode, if we can call it that. It was really rather terrifying. Britain responded fairly rapidly by removing the things from the cattle food chain that are likely to spread mad cow disease. And mostly those mean other animals which might be infected. And as we've said, beef cattle are herbivores. They're vegetarians. They're not meant to eat any other animals, least of all, other cattle. In this country, unfortunately, we're testing less than 1% of our animals destined for slaughter for mad cow disease. So if there is a problem, I don't think we'll be very aware of the extent of it. And our policies on feeding are not as strict as they should be. So they've banned from feeding to any beef cattle brain and spinal cord material, for example, which is among the most likely things to infect cattle. But there's still three holes in the feed ban, as we might say. And one is that calves are still fed milk replacer, which is made of bovine or cattle blood. Another is that poultry litter or waste may still be fed to factory animals, and that can, through the kind of loops in the food chain, can include other animal parts. And then finally, they're allowed to feed what's called plate waste. This basically means the stuff that you don't finish in restaurants. So somebody's, you know, half-finished plate of beef with broccoli may well be cattle feed.
God. So you're saying that they're feeding beef, they're feeding calves chicken manure?
Yeah, poultry litter. It's one of these hideous efficiencies, so-called, about industrial agriculture. Poultry litter contains a fair amount of protein and roughage, and so that's why it's been a factory feed. Beef cattle, all they need is grass. Literally, all they need is grass and the little weeds, which are called forbs. If they have a broadleaf, they're called a forb. Grass and forbs will produce the most beautiful and tender and delicious and healthy red meat you can get.
Yeah, you know, I think this is one of the things that your book really gave me an appreciation of, and that is that we are not only what we eat, but we are what we eat eats.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, and I use this in the fats chapters, because a good rule of thumb is the composition of the fat of an animal, and that includes any animal product, beef or poultry or milk or eggs, tends to depend on what the animal has eaten. And the composition for nutrients and flavor of vegetable fats and oils tends to depend on how we've processed the fats or the oils. So take olive oil, for example. You want it cold-pressed extra virgin because that preserves all the vitamin E and the antioxidants in the olive oil. If it's refined under high heat and extracted and put in water centrifuges, you lose the vitamin E and the antioxidants.
And even salt. You know, I go out and I buy sea salt, which I think is a good and virtuous thing for me. I've also used kosher salt. But you say even there that we have to go a little bit further.
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing about salt that I learned from a salt farmer, for lack of a better word, on the Atlantic coast of France near Bordeaux. The salt you want to look for is unrefined sea salt, because once again, it's very common in salt processing for them to remove some nutrients from the salt before they sell it to you. And what would those be? Well, salt is mostly sodium chloride. It's about 84% sodium chloride when it comes out of the sea. And the other 16% is all kinds of trace elements like iodine, which your body needs only in minute quantities, but they're essential to the balanced complexity that is salt. They strip all those away when they refine salt. And so what you want is sea salt that has had nothing taken out except water, and all the trace elements are still there.
But isn't salt bad for you? I mean, once you get older, your blood pressure is going to rise if you eat a lot of salt. I mean, we're all cautioned against salt. So what's the deal here?
Well, I looked at several studies that concluded that salt itself is not responsible for high blood pressure and heart disease. Again, it's a matter of balance. The body wants a balance of sodium chloride and potassium. You get potassium from eating fruits and vegetables. And certainly industrial foods contain too much 100% pure sodium chloride. Almost every food that comes into my house isn't salted, so I salt generously in cooking and the table.
You know, you talk about balance here. There's a couple of other balances that you have in your book that I also found pretty interesting. Let's talk about cholesterol. You know, talk about the HDL and LDL. We all hear that the HDL, the high DL is good for you. The low DL is bad for you. But you say that this is not really the case. So,
yeah.
So talk about this, and where do we find these different DLs?
Yes, that's the current thinking, that HDL, high density lipoprotein, it stands for, is good for you, and low density lipoprotein is not good for you. None of these are cholesterol, by the way. They just carry cholesterol, so that itself is kind of a misnomer. And then there's this yet another category called very low density lipoprotein, VLDL, which they consider truly villainous. The question really is, what is cholesterol doing in the body? The first thing to know is that you get some of it from your diet, butter and eggs, for example, and the rest of it your body manufactures. We now know that the relationship between dietary cholesterol, the cholesterol you eat, and blood cholesterol is very weak, so they've pretty much discarded that. That's why egg yolks are very much back on the menu. We've known since 1999 that people who eat more eggs have less heart disease.
More eggs?
Yeah. So it shows you how long it takes popular wisdom to catch up with the science, because I still, just the other day in my local bookshop here in New York City, found a book for the Egg White Cookbook, which began with a classic egg white omelet. I thought, in what culture is that classic? In no culture. Anyway, and the ingredients were egg whites, chives, non-fat cooking spray, and optional non-fat cheese. This was then described as a comfort food. Anyway, so that's the first thing to know about cholesterol. You can eat natural, fresh cholesterol in real foods, and you're not going to clog your arteries. However, you do want to worry about one kind of cholesterol, which, surprise, surprise, is found in industrial foods, and that's oxidized cholesterol. And particularly in your vein, in your arteries, rather, LDL gets oxidized. Where do you find oxidized cholesterol? In powdered milk and powdered eggs. two industrial foods they came up with, oh, you know, in the mid-50s. And basically they've spray-dried this milk. They sort of spray it against a screen and then dry it under heat, and they do the same thing with eggs. And it makes a kind of milk or egg substitute full of oxidized cholesterol, which is definitely linked to clogged arteries and arteriosclerosis. But then now, HDL and LDL, it's true. With HDL, the higher the better. So my mother's HDL is high. I'm delighted. Generally, the higher your HDL, the longer your life. And the conventional medical establishment is catching up to that now. But they're still very afraid of this LDL business. And some of the most interesting researchers I consulted, and all of their books are quoted in my book and linked on my website, so you can look it up yourself if you're as skeptic as I was, think that LDL is a repair molecule and it goes to the scene of a damaged artery. It is not the cause of the damaged artery. So, you know, go into a burning building in New York City and you'll see lots of New York Fire Department men, but that doesn't mean they started the fire.
Right, so it goes there to kind of repair the damage. And you say that they need to be in balance. They should be in a one-to-one balance. And I believe you say that most of the foods that are recommended are way high in this omega-6.
Yes, so this is another great story about balance. You're talking about the omega fats, which people are now getting to know, the omega-3 fats, which you find in fish, and the omega-6 fats, which you mostly find in vegetable oils, like olive oil or corn oil. And here, the body needs both kinds, but they produce, or the body produces from these fats, certain hormone-like agents called prostaglandins, which regulate dozens and dozens of functions in the body, from fertility to inflammation to immunity. And again, the body wants to have about equal amounts, because you need some omega-6 for inflammation. If you cut yourself, a little bit of inflammation helps you heal, but you need some omega-3 to keep inflammation from running amok. We now know that inflammation is a big cause of heart disease. And what does the industrial diet offer us? 20 times more omega-6 fats than omega-3 fats. It means we're eating 20 times more corn oil than wild salmon. And the results of an imbalance, that is an excess of omega-6 fats, are plain to see in the research. They are obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and to a lesser extent, cancer and depression.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mention those things, because my stepfather has advanced heart disease and has had diabetes for a long time. Mm. And his wife, not my mom, but his wife has been watching over his diet assiduously for years, all low fat, no eggs, no cheese, never any meat other than fish. I mean, she's got the fish thing down. But with all her loving care, you say she may not be doing him all that much good.
It's unfortunate, and it's not her fault, because for the last 30 years, that has been the advice. Eat more polyunsaturated corn oil. Eat low-fat milk. What the diet I would put anyone I love on, if diabetes and heart disease were a concern, would be real food, and I would be radically cutting out the industrial foods. White sugar, white flour, corn oil, trans fats, of course, of all kinds.
Trans fats are the...
Yeah, so trans fats are the fat they invented to replace butter, basically. They took liquid vegetable oils and they said, hey, if we throw hydrogen atoms at these at very high speeds, we can artificially saturate them, and then they'll be firm at room temperature and they'll be shelf stable. And so that's what all those butter substitutes were about. And it was thought then that saturated fat in butter was bad and these polyunsaturated fats were good. We now know that the only thing natural saturated fats like butter do is raise your HDL, so that's a good thing. And meanwhile, we discover that the trans fats that are formed in this process of hydrogenation, always an extra syllable in there I miss. Anyway, that they're responsible, this is according to Walter Willett at Harvard, for 100,000 premature deaths from heart disease in America every year.
And so I think I had it wrong, because this is kind of confusing. You have to keep your omega-6 and your omega-3 in balance on a one-to-one, but don't you also have to balance your HDL and LDL? As you say, don't they also kind of have to be more or less in equal balance with each other?
There probably is a healthy balance there, but I don't know exactly what it is. We do know that some natural saturated fats like coconut oil tend to bring it into balance. If the HDL is low and the LDL is high, coconut oil will adjust them, and vice versa. The studies on when high HDL or LDL is a risk factor, that is, predicts for heart disease. I would say that the field is changing rapidly there. I have seen some terrific studies, but they're new, suggesting that high LDL means a longer life. This probably has to do with immunity. It turns out that low cholesterol is bad for your immunity, but all this research is yet to be pinned down.
Wow. You know, it just seems like no sooner do you make a decision to eat something or do something one way, and a study comes along to tell you it's different. Now tell us about your website, though. Give us that link, and we'll post it on our website, too, so
sure.
Listeners can go to it.
Just to say one thing about the fact that the research is in flux, that is frustrating, I know. But the advice has been pretty consistent for the last 30 years, and Americans have pretty devotedly followed it. They've been eating more corn oil and less butter. That advice is just lagging the science. The official advice is lagging the science. But the good news is, if your grandmother ate it, it's probably okay. And if they invented it since about 1950, it may not be. So people don't need to worry too much about the headlines going back and forth if they just concentrate on real food.
That's a pretty simple guide. That's a good one.
And my website, thanks for asking, it's ninaplank.com, and you spell Plank, P-L-A-N-C-K. And there are excerpts from my book, which are free. There are reviews, there are articles, and lots of links to my sources, not only where I buy real food, which is under shopping list, but also some of the experts I'm quoting in the book.
Another point you make in your book is that if you eat this way, you will eat less because you'll be more satisfied.
Yeah, it depends on who you are, but I must say that I effortlessly lost 25 pounds when I switched from a non-fat and low-fat vegetarian diet to a real food diet, which included real fats and as many of them as I wanted. I'm not sure. Industrial food is sort of addictive but not satisfying.
Well, say more about that and talk about the connection between industrial food and obesity.
Well, I think if we were looking at the causes of obesity, we could eliminate a few things like milk, because milk consumption in teenagers, say, has declined steadily for 20 years while weight gain and obesity have risen. And we can look instead to the things that have increased in our diet since the 1970s. And there I'm afraid that corn oil and corn syrup and white flour are the main culprits. It's the refined foods, the white foods, the foods that don't have many nutrients in them and have plenty of calories that are probably responsible.
And they make you hungrier as well, as you point out.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say exactly what addiction is, but I used to be find it habit-forming, shall we say, to have a non-fat frozen yogurt. This was all through my non-fat vegan and vegetarian years. And I had one of those yogurts, which are all over the place, pretty much every day after lunch. But now those taste bland and dull to me. They have no flavor, no mouthfeel. They're really the lowest form of milk. And they didn't have any nutrients in them either, just artificial flavors and colors and non-fat milk powder.
You know, one final thing, and that is, you know, Americans relate to their food, and we've certainly been talking about this way, like it's medicine. And I think that's great. You know, we're interested in that. We want to improve our health. But, you know, in other words, we kind of eat it because it's good for us.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is that this is a really foreign notion to exactly those cultures, say, like the French and the Italians, who eat real food.
Yeah. I don't know how much our obsession with health has helped us, ironically. And so it might be good if we return to some of the sensory and social pleasures of food, and we didn't always think of it as a kind of health equation every time we lifted the fork to our mouths. The slow food people, I think, are wonderful with this term eco-gastronomy. And if people don't know slow food, it started in Italy. It's now an international group with chapters all over the world, including the U.S., in defense of traditional food, basically. So their term eco-gastronomy encompasses ecology, that slow food is better for the environment, and taste, which is the gastronomy part. And I realize that it's very characteristically American and sort of geeky of me, but I'm just trying to add the nutrition part back in, because I want them to know if they eat butter because it tastes better, they can also feel good that it's good for them.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, that's the most inspiring part of the equation, I think, of your book, Real Food, what to eat and why, and that is that not only is good for you, but it tastes good too.
It's the gospel. It's the good news all around.
It is. That's great. The gospel of good eating. Well, thank you, Nina Plank, so much for talking with Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Food writer Nina Plank. Next up after the break, food psychologist Brian Wanzink on mindless eating, why we eat more than we think. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. Well, Thanksgiving signals the start of the holiday and gluttony season. Americans typically gain several pounds that they then struggle and often fail to lose again, and diets don't usually work in the long run. The problem is how to resist temptation that lures us from all sides. Food psychologist Brian Wanzink has the answer. He's been studying the mindless eating that packs on pounds, those 100 to 300 extra calories a day we consume without even thinking about it. And he's come up with ways that we can mindlessly lose weight. I can tell you it works. His book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, has changed the way I look at food. No longer mindlessly subject to the subtle cues in my environment that tell me to eat more, the pounds are already coming off. Mindlessly. Brian Wanzink, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm pleased to be with you.
You are the director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, and a lot of what you found out that you put in your book, you found out from that lab. Tell us about it, and also tell us about the restaurant, the Spice Box.
Okay. Well, the lab is a series of rooms that are connected together to my office, actually, and they've got one-way mirrors, we've got hidden cameras, we have scales underneath plates. We've got a lot of things like this that can enable us to change something and observe how it influences how much somebody eats or how much they like food. So we can change the lighting, we can change plate size, we can change the variety of food we give people, we can have it be distracting or not distracting, we can turn on different TV shows. We can do all this in a really, really nice, controlled environment that within 3 hours we can change to look like a kitchen or a dining room or a den or a living room. And what happens is if once we find out that something works in a lab, then what we'll do is we'll move out into the real world and we'll examine this in movie theaters or in restaurants or in bars or at parties to see if the things we find that work in the lab also translate into real life. When you asked about the Spice Box, too, and the Spice Box is actually it's similar. What it is it's a restaurant that's only open one day a week, and people come in and they pay a prefix. They pay like about $25 for a prefix menu, and we do the exact same thing in there. We might change the name or label on the wine and see how it influences how much of a meal people eat. We might change the lighting. We might have something unusual happen that throws people off to see how they respond in the way they eat. It enables us, again, to test the very specific things that we think are almost invisible to most people, but which influence how much they eat or how much they like food.
Well, tell us some of those things. Like, for example, what happens when you change the label on a wine?
Okay. Well, we actually did do that in the Spice Box. What we did is we brought people in for a nice French prefix meal. And it was the middle of February and cold night. And we said, hey, thanks for keeping your reservation. Because you kept the reservation, we'd like to offer you a complimentary glass of wine. And what we did was we had a very cheap bottle of $2 bottle of wine that we'd soaked the label off. And what we did is we put on fake labels, which said that it was either this Cabernet from California, a place known for wine, respected for wine, or we put on a label that said a Cabernet from North Dakota. Not a place known for wine, not necessarily a place very well respected for wine. And we know from a prior study that when people end up drinking something that they believe is going to taste good, they do evaluate it as better. They essentially look for those good qualities and those good aspects, and their taste buds conveniently confirm their expectations. Well, in this case, we weren't interested in what they why wine tastes like. We were interested in how it influenced the rest of the meal and what we found if people thought they're eating a California, drinking a California wine, they loved the food. They ate 10 minutes longer. They ate 11% more of the food. If they had one from North Dakota, it just wasn't as good. They just finished up dinner and left, and they left a lot more of their food in their plate.
So their expectations determined how they actually tasted or enjoyed the food.
You know, absolutely. But, I mean, you know, we've known this for a lot of studies we've done in cafeterias. We've gone to cafeterias and to restaurants, and we've changed the names of the menus. So, you know, 1 week the menu item would be called seafood filet, and the next week it would be called succulent Italian seafood filet. Well, in reality, it's just like a dried-up fish stick. But the people who eat the thing that they believe is a succulent Italian seafood filet, I mean, they rate the foods better, they rate the restaurants better, and after they finish eating, they actually believe that the chef has had probably 1 to 2 years of culinary training overseas.
Now, why do you think people do? Now, you've mentioned two things. One was a $2 bottle of wine.
Yeah, $2 chuck.
And the other is exactly $2 chuck. And the other was from a box of, I assume, frozen dried up fish sticks, right?
Yeah. So this is bad cafeteria seafood.
Yeah. So what is it that gets people to fool themselves that something tastes good that really doesn't taste that great?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, what's going on is we have so many things going in our life that our life pretty much becomes filled with mindless eating because we parallel process things. We end up doing a lot of stuff at the same time. And eating can be a fairly automatic activity, as can the evaluation of food. So we're probably more interested in what our dinner mates are talking about or how work's going or something like that. So the evaluation of food becomes very peripheral. And when something's very peripheral, we end up being very easily influenced by the little cues around us, whether it be names and labels or whether it be packages and plates or whether it be music and lighting.
So your book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And you also talk about something called the mindless margin. What is that?
Well, what happens is that the majority of people who gain weight in a year gain it at less than 2 to 3 pounds a year. I mean, that's a difference of 25 calories. And 25 calories extra a day is really, you know, nothing more than about 5 M&Ms or about 8 Tic Tacs. So there's very few calories we eat in excess every day that lead us to gain weight. The mindless margin is the number of calories we can trim out of our day without noticing it physiologically, without noticing it psychologically, that can end up leading to weight loss. And we estimate that very, very, very conservatively to be as much as 300 calories. Meaning if we come up with three little changes that cut 300 calories out of our day, we're not going to miss it from a physiological or psychological standpoint. We're not going to have headaches. We're not going to have stomach growling. But over the course of a year, 300 extra calories, 300 less calories a day translates into 30 less pounds at the end of the year. And that's the mindless margin.
And we're talking with Brian Wanzink, and the book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. You know, I have to say, I was really astonished. I mean, the idea that one could lose 30 pounds almost effortlessly, well, that's going to be the subject of most of what we talk about today, how you actually do that, really surprised me. Have you seen this work with people? I mean, do you know people that's worked with?
Yeah, actually, we know it actually works for most of the people in the lab. Most of the people who start in the lab, we know what cues lead people to overeat, so we gradually find that people, you know, start doing the small things that our study suggests, and all of a sudden we find people losing quite a bit of weight very quickly. I mean, not very quickly, but over the course of the year, we'll find people will drop down to a low BMI very, very quickly.
You mean your colleagues?
Yeah, my colleagues. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk about some of those cues. I have to say, this is a hugely entertaining book. And I had to laugh out loud at some of the experiments that you did. One of them was the bottomless soup bowl.
Well, what happens is most people believe they're master and commander of all their food choices. I mean, they believe that they know when they're full. In reality, we have very little idea when we're full sometimes because we end up eating largely with our eyes instead of our stomach. I mean, at the extremes, we would know we are full, but in the middle, we're not really that aware of being full. And if you're to ask most people, when are you through eating? Most people would say, oh, I'm pretty much through eating when the plate's empty or when my bowl's empty. We thought we'd figure out what happens if the plate never empties. What happens if your bowl never empties? And we designed these refillable soup bowls, these bottomless soup bowls, where we drilled holes in the bottom of bowls and we drilled holes through the table and connected using food-grade tubing the bowl through the table over to a big 6-quart cauldron of soup. Now, in doing this, a person could theoretically eat 6 quarts of soup before they ever hit the bottom of the soup bowl, because as they eat, the level goes down, but then it slowly, slowly, slowly refills itself. And what we find is that when we bring people in for lunch and they eat away, we stop them after 20 minutes. They've eaten 73% more soup in a refillable soup bowl than they did a normal one. Yet, when we ask them to rate how full they are, they don't rate themselves as being any more full. Because after all, I mean, they've only eaten half a bowl of soup. There's still a half a bowl left. How can they be full?
But they did say that the soup was good and filling.
Yeah, they did. They did. They did like the taste of the soup, even though they ended up, you know, eating it ad nauseum.
You know, how do you guys think up these experiments? You know, I have this image that you all sit around a table and you do a lot of chuckling.
Oh yeah, we do. We've got very funny people in the lab, and we've always, I mean, something you'd be attracted to something as non-traditional and academic as food psychology. That person's got to have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I decided I needed to go on a crash diet because I'm going to be going to an award ceremony. And actually, in all modesty, I'm going to be one of the people getting you an award for a documentary I did last year. And I thought, oh, my God, now I have got to lose those extra 10 pounds. So I went on the Atkins diet. Mm-hmm. And within 3 days, I'd had enough.
Well, that's one. One thing about that deprivation diets is people can lose weight on them, but not mere mortals. Boy, I think the people who can really lose a lot of weight on these, it's got to become a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
I had the good fortune to work and write a number of things with Mike Huckabee, who's the governor of Arkansas, and who's ended up losing about 120 pounds in a year
right. Just
through discipline and exercise. And so we know it can be done, but for most of us, most people don't want to lose 120 pounds. Most people would be happy. In fact, a recent study we did showed that most people, around 80%, would be happy if they lost 20 pounds or less,
mm-hmm.
Actually 18 pounds or less. But for 18 pounds or less, boy, going on a deprivation diet is just not going to cut it for most of us. It's a whole lot easier to just trim 100, 150 calories out of your day, and at the end of the year, you'll easily be 10 or 15 pounds less without even knowing you've been on a diet.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with food psychologist Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. You talked about the mindless margin, how we mm-hmm. mindlessly put on the weight. And, of course, that leads to also then, you know, setting things up in your life so that you mindlessly lose weight, I think, is kind of the point of your book.
Absolutely, yes.
I wanted to ask you, what are some of the major cues or major ways that people are mindless about food? I mean, you talked about, you know, that we're distracted a bit. I wonder if you could talk more about that and some of the other ways also that we set ourselves up for failing to lose weight.
Mm. Well, one thing is that we make over 200 food decisions a day. I mean, we think we make about 15. In reality, we make well over 200 food decisions a day. I mean, even for breakfast, we're deciding which cereal to have, but how much to pour, whether to put skim milk or whole milk, whether to put sugar on it, whether to cut a banana. We make 15 decisions before we even have a bite to eat. But the thing is, we're not even aware of having made those. And so at every one of those points when we make a decision, whether it be how much milk to pour or how much cereal to pour, we can easily be influenced by a peripheral cue that suggests that we maybe pour a little bit more than we otherwise would have. The bowl size, for instance, will encourage us to pour more. The size of the container of milk is going to lead us to pour more. A huge cereal box will have us pour more. Mm-hmm. All these things have very subtle influences. But as we know, hey, very small influences that just lead us to eat 25 calories more lead us to gain 2.5 pounds over the course of a year. And so that's what we need to target at Turning Around.
Now, what would you do with that? You know, you got your Cheerios box. You got the economy size. So it's a big one.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing would be as simple as say, you know, buy a smaller box. But, you know, that's ridiculous for a lot of us because we want to buy the economy size because we save a lot of money. An easier thing to do would just be to simply use smaller bowls and put the box of cereal not on the table, but leave it on the counter. Hey, you can have seconds if you want to. But we find that simply having something 6 feet away, whether it be a candy dish or a cereal box or a bowl of pasta, leads people to end up eating less over the course of their meal because at some point you just don't mindlessly pour another bowl. You say, eh, do I really want some? And that 6 feet gives you pause to say, am I really hungry? And oftentimes, half the time, in some of our studies, the answer is no.
Half the time.
Yeah, we did a series of studies that were it was fun. It was with secretaries at a university, and this was when I was at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we enlisted a number of secretaries in the study and gave them a month's worth of chocolates, these are Hershey Kisses, and put them. We either placed them on their desk, or we placed them just 6 feet from their desk, and every single night we went and refilled all these bowls, counting how many they'd eaten. And we found that the typical person with a bowl on their desk ended up eating about 9 of these Hershey Kisses every single day, which is about 225 calories. If it was moved just 6 feet off their desk, the exact same person would end up eating 4 candies, which is about 100 calories. So simply having it on her desk, if she did it every day for a year, she'd be 12 pounds heavier. But having it 6 feet, it was interesting when we did the debriefing and we talked to people and you say, was it, is it that much of a hassle just to walk 2 steps? Is that why you ate so few candies when it was moved off your desk? They'd say, no, it's not that it's much of a hassle. It's just that that 6 feet gave me pause to ask myself, hey, am I really that hungry? Half the time they asked themselves that, they came up with the answer, no.
Right, and also it was out of their line of vision. You know, it's funny you said secretaries in the universities because I just noticed that every secretary I know has a bowl of candy on her desk.
No, we call them social magnets. When we'll talk to people that are perpetually dieting, they'll say, hey, why do you have that bowl on your desk? You know what's going to happen. They go, yeah, but you know, it's a conversation piece. People come by, they'll stop by, they'll talk. I make people smile when they stop by. Well, hey, we've got about 400 candy dishes in our lab because that's basically, you know, a lot of that in the food lab. People stop by expecting to have food. But what we've done is we just replaced all the candy we like with candy we don't like. So instead of having the chocolates and things, we've replaced it with sweet and sour candies like, you know, sweet tarts and things like that, which we don't like quite so much. Hey, they're no temptation for us, but people still stop by.
And you mentioned portion, you know, the size of the bowl. What about the size of the food, the size of the portions? I mean, what's happened to these over the last, you know, in the last 30 years?
Oh, well, the same thing has happened to our kitchens. They've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger because why? Well, because we can afford it, because we're a country with a lot of space. And so we're always looking for value. And the first time that a restaurant decides to increase the size of its fries by 25%, its competitors have a choice. They can either increase the size of their fries 25% and be seen as an equal bargain, or they can keep them where they're at and be seen as expensive. So what we have is sort of an escalation of competition among restaurants.
Yeah, you know, it's always very frustrating to me because even around here, which is kind of, you know, you live in Ithaca, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Well, this is kind of the alternative Ithaca here.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Pioneer Valley. And there are a lot of really wonderful little cafes that have, you know, a lot of good healthy food in them, but the size of their cookies, my goodness, are the size of dinner plates. You know, and when you ask, do you have anything that's smaller? No, they don't.
You know, why would we have that? That's right. Well, you know, one of the real dangers that goes on in some of these places is a health halo, too, that you can have a very wonderful restaurant that makes very healthy food, but there's a tendency that we fall into, and this is a tendency of applying this health halo to, first of all, everything that a restaurant like that makes, but second of all, what it leads us to do is to compensate. We call it compensating behavior. So, for instance, we find when people eat what they consider to be a relatively healthy lunch, they're more likely to order chips and order cookies than when they eat something that they know is otherwise fairly indulgent. So in one study, we call them a Subway study, we found that people who ate, we intercepted people as they left either Subways or McDonald's that were within half a block of each other. And we found that the people leaving McDonald's, of course, they ate more food and they ate more calories. They ate about 1,000 calories, but they estimated that they ate about 900. The people leaving Subway ate less calories. They ate about 700 calories, but they estimated they ate about 400. Because what happened? Hey, they believed everything they ate there was healthy, but that didn't include the cheese. It didn't include the mayonnaise. It didn't include the chips, and it didn't include the cookies they ordered.
And they didn't know how many. You said people consistently underestimate the amount of calories that they take in.
Every single one of us underestimates the number of calories we take in by an average of 20%. Mm-hmm. But that's those who are of normal weight. If somebody's heavy, they underestimate it by closer to 40 or 50%.
Why is that?
What's interesting, in the past, clinicians have treated this, when they've treated a heavy person who's come in for diet counseling, they often say, well, you are underreporting what you eat because either you don't have the knowledge to know what you're eating, you know, you're ignorant, or because you're lying to yourself or you're lying to us. And holy cow, that would be the end of the counseling session as far as I'd be concerned if, you know, if somebody would treat you that way. What we found in studies that happens is that regardless of whether a person is popsicle skinny or heavy, everybody underestimates the size of a very, very large meal. Okay, let's say, for instance, it's a 2,000-calorie Thanksgiving dinner. The heavy person and the skinny person alike are going to estimate the same dinner as being about 1,000 calories. And it has nothing to do with their weight. It's just that really huge meals tend to be underestimated in a mathematical, predictable way by everybody. The problem is that heavy people just eat a lot more 2,000-calorie meals than the skinny person.
We're talking with Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. Now, you did mention Thanksgiving, and we're broadcasting this, unfortunately, the day after Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm sure people will still have plenty of leftovers.
Oh, they will.
So this will be good advice for them. And I tell you the truth, I'm always afraid, you know, because I love Thanksgiving and I love the good food. But I know that when I see the groaning board that has, you know, 20 different dishes on it and 5 different desserts, well, I want to have a little taste of each one of them. And even if I just take a tablespoon of each one, well, I end up with, the Himalayan mountains on my plate.
Oh, that is true. Well, there's a couple of things to do in that case like that. If it's a buffet line, what you can do is you can just simply put 2 items on your plate at any one time and kind of go back. And that ends up being nice because you eat the things you like best first. And eventually, going back for thirds or fourths is okay, but not fifths or sixths, and you decide you've had enough. That's one thing. A better thing to do if you're doing a sit-down dinner with other people is, when you do this, use what we call the half-plate rule. Now, a lot of us don't have a benchmark as to what's right to eat and how much to eat, but if you use the half-plate rule, it gives you that benchmark. The half-plate rule is you simply say, look, half my plate, I can put anything I want to. The other half of the plate has to be fruits, or it has to be, you know, vegetables, salads, and fruits. If the other half is all meat and carbos, hey, that's fine. But at least half the plate has to be vegetables, fruits, and salads. What that leads people to do is at least to fill up in some of the less calorie-dense stuff.
Right. And so they're actually eating healthily, and then they're not quite so hungry. But what about that dessert pouch? You know, there's that extra dessert pouch. Because no matter how much I fill up on the vegetables, I'm still ready to eat 3 desserts if they're in front of me.
Well, one thing you can do with desserts is you can see them as part of a larger meal. So, for instance, you don't want to go through the entire meal kind of complaining about how you're on a diet and how it's ruining your diet. Because, you know, you're going to have less fun, and believe me, everybody around you is not going to be grateful for it either. So one thing to do is to give yourself the freedom to eat some of the things you want by saying, hey, look, you know, in addition to the main central dishes, if you're at a restaurant, it'd be the appetizer, or it'd be the entree, in addition to these main central dishes, you know, I can have two other items. That could be, you know, the appetizer or the chips that were passed around before the dinner. It could be the bread that's passed around at dinner. It could be wine if you're having wine, or it could be a dessert. You can have any two of those items, but you can't have all four. The problem with desserts comes in not necessarily because of the dessert, but because of the fact that prior to that dessert, we had had the bread. We had had all the appetizers that were passed around. We had had all the side dishes.
And does this work for you, too, at Thanksgiving dinner?
Yeah. In some cases, there's some meals that just really aren't really worth monitoring tremendously closely.
Right.
And like a Thanksgiving dinner, if a person was on a cruise and trying to watch their weight, well, that's sort of a bad idea. You shouldn't be on a cruise because you're losing all the advantage of being on a cruise. In some situations, hey, they come around so seldom, it's not really worth obsessing about that one situation. Hey, but tell you what, the day after Thanksgiving, 2 days after Thanksgiving, 3 days after Thanksgiving, for the 3 weeks before
Christmas,
the holidays start again, mm-hmm. you can watch what you do. And then it becomes very easy coming up with some of these very small changes that can lead you to mindlessly eat less, can put you on the right track, keep you on track, even though Thanksgiving was a blowout.
Well, you know, I'm going to get you on that word mindless, because actually there's an awful lot of mindfulness that goes into adjusting one's environment, one's eating environment. So you mentioned, for example, putting the high carb or the sugar items on another counter. So there's some mindfulness there. You also talk about something that, you know, I'm very attached to, and that is, you know, when I eat alone, I'm reading or listening to the radio or both.
Or on the computer even sometimes. Oh,
exactly. That's the other thing. Eating, you talk about desktop dining. So you talk about applying mindfulness to be able to mindlessly lose some weight.
And well, the idea about mindfulness is once you know what's leading you to eat 50, 75, 100 more calories of the mashed potatoes you just had or the dessert you just had, once you know what does that, just turning that around so it works for you and just do that habitually, it works real well. So we find that people who have the habit of meal stuffing, which is overeating meals a lot, one reason this occurs is because they're very fast eaters. They'll start eating, and they'll continue to eat until everybody at the table is through eating. It means taking seconds of this, thirds of that, seconds of this. And before you know it, they've consumed an immense number of calories just simply because they're waiting for other people to finish. Now, with these people, we'll videotape the dinners, and the next day we'll say, hey, how many helpings did you have last night of mashed potatoes? And they'll go, No, I think I had two. You'll show them the videotape, and you'll say, would you believe four? Because the problem is they just mindlessly refill their plate. Doing something as simple as moving those heavy dishes, the starches and the foods, off the table just a few feet, whether it be back on the stove or whether it be a sideboard or whether it be a counter, I will guarantee will cut 30% of the calories out of most meal stuffers' dinners.
Finally, you had a very interesting chapter, I think, about kids. You know, the current generation of children is really on its way to be the fattest ever. Experts are forecasting an epidemic of diabetes down the road. You say that there's a change that happens in kids between the ages of 3 and 5 that can really set them up for trouble.
Oh, absolutely. We do. Well, the chapter that you mentioned in the book just a moment ago is called The Nutritional Gatekeepers. It's actually one of my favorite chapters because it really shows how the patterns that we've ended up developing or inheriting from our parents end up being the exact same patterns that we very carelessly pass on to our children. And with the big concern of childhood obesity, there ends up being an awful lot of finger-pointing at a lot of external forces that are external to the household, whether it be the food industry or the schools or the government. But the real encouraging thing is that there's very small shifts that most people can make in their patterns at home that really can put their kids back onto a good path. And we find that even at a very young age, between 3 and 5, we see big differences at daycare centers in the way different children eat. And we believe almost all of these can be traced back to the home.
So, for example, I mean, I think you say that, you know, until the age of three, kids will stop when they're full, but that that changes afterwards. It kind of the social influences then become more primary. Is that right?
Yeah. It used to be believed that children know when they're full, but that they lose this ability to determine this as they grow older, and they end up being very easily influenced simply by the size of the cereal box or the shape of a bowl, or by whether there's fun music playing in the background while they pour something like this. And parents can have a really profound impact on children, both on sort of the variety of foods they end up eating, but then also on how frequently they eat. And we find that some of the kids, and this is an initial finding we talk about in the book, that some of the kids in our experiments end up having the healthiest eating habits, even as five-year-olds, end up growing up in a family where there's a lot of variety of food that's been served to them as they've been growing up. As a result, they don't just have a taste for sugar, salt, and fatty foods.
You have something called the Popeye Project.
We are.
Popeye the Sailor Man. And actually, when I was a kid, I was told that spinach, you know, spinach will make you strong like Popeye.
No, that's what's interesting. In 1928, there was a survey of children asking them what their three favorite foods were. And ice cream was one of the three favorite foods. And one of the other three was spinach. It's hard to believe that that was back when Popeye was being released, and there's such great associations that it worked hard. What we've done in the Popeye Project is we've gone around to talk to over 200 small children who are 4 to 5 years old, and we've asked them, hey, what's your favorite vegetable? And most of the kids don't really have one, but we started finding out there's certain kids who really had extreme favorites, like broccoli or something like seaweed or things like this. And when these non-kid-friendly vegetables would pop up as a child's favorite, we'd ask them a lot of questions, and then we'd ask their parents a lot of questions to try to figure out how they developed a taste for this stuff. And it's amazing because so many of these end up being driven by these really great associations these kids have. They're totally independent in the vegetables. So, for instance, we found these brothers that really liked broccoli. And we asked them why. They said, well, because it looks like dinosaur trees. And so, you know, it's kind of weird. But in interviewing their mom, we found that their mom had said, broccoli is like a dinosaur tree. And when you eat it, you're like a long necked green dinosaur eating a dinosaur tree. Hey, at the dinosaur loving age of four, this is a great association.
That's wonderful. So associations not only work with adults, as in the case of the Cabernet from California, but with kids too.
Yeah, we did some studies at some vacation Bible schools where we renamed foods. And so I feel guilty about this one, but there's a kind of a V8 drink, kind of a tomatoey V8 drink. And we renamed it a rainforest smoothie. A rainforest smoothie. What we ended up finding out was we couldn't even keep the stuff in stock when we did that.
That's great. So, well, the book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And Brian Wansink, thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Well, I appreciate it. And the website, mindlesseating.org, has a whole lot more tips about this if you're interested.
Great. And we'll link to that on our website.
Perfect.
Wonderful. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Food psychologist Brian Wansink. That's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Please join us next week for a conversation with Michael Schumann about Small Mart Revolution, how local businesses are beating the local competition. We also talk with author Shel Horowitz about his new book, Grassroots Marketing for Authors and Publishers. To learn more about Writer's Voice, visit our website at writersvoice.net. Please send your thoughts, comments, and questions to write@writersvoice.net. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.